I'm no millionaire, but I'm not the type to care, 'cause I've got a pocket full of dreams.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Check your Facebook or your Instagram feed right now, and the chances are good you might know someone who is, at this moment, traveling through Europe. Not that it is an inexpensive trip, but we're a mobile enough society that hearing about a trip to Europe these days hardly raises an eyebrow.
Americans traveled to Europe in the 1930s as well, but for many who did in those days, it qualified as the trip of a lifetime. That was certainly the case for Frank J. Daly, a 30-year-old schoolteacher from Chicago. Daly spent 2 months in Europe in 1936, a time when the specter of war was beginning to loom.
Daly passed away some time ago, and his trip would have been long ago forgotten, except that a 2-volume journal of his journey survived and was discovered by his son, Milwaukee attorney Frank Daly. And the writing was vivid enough that Daly thought others might want to read it as well. And so, with the assistance of journalist and editor Kurt Chandler, the book My Trip Abroad, Europe in 1936 was born. Daly and Chandler are with us in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Mitch. Good to be here.
Frank Daly, when did you first read your father's travel journal?
Shortly after the time that I discovered it among his belongings after his death in 1997, when we were cleaning out his belongings back in Chicago, and it was contained in these journals which we found, which were sort of at the bottom of a box that had many other mementos in it and some of his writings and other things that we were going through trying to determine what to keep and what not to. And I read hurriedly through it. Oh, and was astounded because I did not know they existed. Nice thing, it seems to be jiving with what I'd been told as a boy, and then being the extraordinarily efficient and capable estate administrator, I thought, well, we probably don't need these. Where am I going to put these? So I was thinking about discarding them, and my wife, Julie Ebert, another lawyer from Coralsbury, said, "No, well, you know, this is the kind of thing that you might regret that if you do that. And even though it might be in our basement, that's okay, because it's the kind of thing that creates a number of memories, and it might be a very valuable memoir someday." And she was absolutely right. So I'm grateful for her insight. And then later had occasion to read a little bit more. And then after my retirement from the active practice of law, I set about the task of trying to dictate these, because I was fairly able to read my father's penmanship, which is sort of elegant but not always legible. And the books were not in the best of condition. Some of the pages had been water stained and were sort of loose and falling, but they were all there. And so after a lot of arduous attempts, I was able to get a working draft of a typewritten version of these so that it would be easier to work with. And then over time, it was edited and re-edited and revised. And upon its completion, it occurred to me that this is something that covers so many topics of interest, particularly during this time in which we live, that it might be worth actually turning it into book form. And that's when I talked to Kurt to get his good assistance and advice on that.
Well, and you said you did not know that these journals existed, but at the same time, it sounds like you were very much aware of this trip. This was something that he talked about.
That's correct. He termed it always as the trip of a lifetime, and had planned that trip, astonishingly to me, from the time he was about a 10-year-old boy till he took the trip when he was age 30. And his feeling of joy and his feeling of fulfillment is just reflected all through the pages of the things that he had so long to see, and obviously had done a great deal of research, which astonishes me. I mean, he was a school teacher, but came from a family where he was the only child of 9 who actually proceeded to school past the age of 16. It was an Irish working family, and people were supposed to go out and start contributing. His father was not happy with his decision to pursue his education. But his education was not just in the classroom or in the work that he did, but rather on his own. And he had read extensively about places in Europe and had a remarkable conception of what they would be like. And then to see that anticipation unfold with his own experiences and his expression of that was a remarkable feeling.
Kurt, so Frank Daly brings you this manuscript. You know, not everybody's journal is really and you know, it's a journal, so it's not necessarily meant for on the record, you know, public reading. What struck you immediately about it that made it worth, you know, made it compelling and worth your time?
Well, I guess initially it was his keen eye for detail. This was a daily journal. So he kept
no notes. Pun intended, by the way.
Right.
Yeah, a daily journal by a daily named Frank. But he really had an eye for even the smallest things. His observations were really spot on, I thought. And they were spot on in the year 1936. So in reading this, you know, 80 years later, I got a real strong sense of history based on his chronicles, his very descriptive chronicles, and that's what pulled me into these journals, to this journal. At first, I thought, okay, well, it's somebody's travel log, but it was far more than that, you know, after I started reading it, and that's what intrigued me.
Well, and I think about, you know, early travel logs, you know, you think of Mark Twain and you think of, you know, you think of some of the classic, you know, Hemingway-esque writers out there. And one of the things that strikes me about this is, you know, this is a travel log written by an ordinary guy, which, you know, there aren't a lot of those out there. How was he even able to make this trip happen? It must have cost a fortune in those days.
It must have, and that's one of the mysteries that I have never quite solved, except that there's mention in the book frequently of a man named William Beale, who was a travel agent, and apparently a friend of my father. I'm not sure how he was a friend all through the time I was a young boy, as a matter of fact. But he somehow must have gotten discounts, gotten other kinds of concessions, and which enabled my father to be able to go. It's also clear that my father had been saving for this trip since it was a trip virtually since the time of being a teenager and when he was earning some money. So it was a combination of those. But I agree, I was amazed at the what this must have cost. I can't imagine what it would cost today. It'd be just staggering. The other thing that occurred to me when I was coming back from New York recently in O'Hare Field and watching people pick up their luggage at the baggage claim areas was, how in the world did he pack for 2 months? And when there were suitcases didn't have wheels, they were not lightweight, there were no backpacks, and yet he had a pack extensively because he had all different environments he was going to be in, including formal attire for being on shipboard for parties and dances and plays and whatnot. Obviously, was something that was planned, and I think that this William Beale was no doubt an important influence, both in terms of his anticipation of it, but also in terms of his ability to know what to pack and how to pack and to how to travel within Europe.
One thing that he does not seem to have had is a camera. In some ways, this journal really seems like it substitutes for having a camera.
You mentioned that's precisely what I felt as I read it. It was like being in the moment with him. It was being and having gone then and using his book as a guide. Something. What he described was a perfect picture of what I was actually looking at, the Colosseum in Rome. All of the places in Paris, the Eiffel Tower, the Sorbonne, the Louvre, Notre Dame, the walk along the Seine with the artists and booksellers, all there when I went there. And just the descriptive talent he had was amazing. His descriptions of the Palace of Versailles, for example, are quite detailed. And when I was there, look, I was just astonished by the minute observations he would make of the gold in the rooms and of the design of the couches and things like that, so that his book actually painted a picture for the mind when you're reading it.
I think his insatiable curiosity is what drove him here and really compelled him to jot things down in this journal every day. He was very disciplined. And he also had, I think, an incredible insight. I mean, he was sort of charmed by European life. I mean, he had never been abroad. And so the customs and the styles and the way people spoke and dressed were all a fascination to him. And it, so, and he was able to just pick little things from his observation, like, for example, he said Italians are much better dancers than Hollanders or Germans.
So he, I know some people in Milwaukee who would dissent strongly to that.
So he was very astute about what was going on around him. He was very present.
You know, and there's so many stops along the way, and obviously we can't talk about all of them,
sure.
But I appreciate that you've been bringing some up. In some ways, it almost feels like a Forrest Gump-like trip through Europe. I mean, he had an audience with the Pope.
Right. Yeah, I'm standing right next to him. Unimaginable, and especially in today's times.
Well, and apparently he knew just how to get that.
Well, again, through
the
travel arrangements that Mr. Beale made and introducing him to a priest who was on board the ship who then had the connections with people in the Vatican. And being from Chicago, my father knew how to use political connections.
He is not from that Daly family.
He's
though.
Not, and it's just regrettable. I might have been a mayor if I'd say.
And a fine mayor.
But I think part of it, Mitch, too, is that I think this book, that he must have done a lot of preparing for this. I mean, he sort of knew in advance what he wanted to see, sort of what it looked like. And I thought each time I read it, I thought it reflected the feeling that anybody who I think travels to Europe or some other foreign for the first time.
And at the same time, he's seeing these things and he's also experiencing what life is becoming as the Nazis have risen
right.
to power in Germany, as the fascists are in power in Italy, and he's able to reflect on what that looks and feels like.
Yes, I thought his comments were very astute, and in particular, there's a few things in there that addresses those questions. And one of them was when he was first docked, the ship was docked off the coast of France while some of its passengers were disembarking. He was standing by the railing observing all this. And he said, you know, there was a gentle wind blowing toward me, which seemed to carry with it the odor of the farms of France. And that also brought me back many years to my pleasant farm vacations in Illinois. A faint suggestion of red in the far western sky caused me to think of the Great War, being World War I, and the fact that the wind I so enjoyed had blown over the graves of millions of dead men buried in Europe. That, to me, was an extraordinary. But then the kicker to that is a prescient comment that says it also suggested the imminence of another great Holocaust brought senselessly because of the selfishness of men and the unwarranted greed for power, which has a real current ring to it, in my view.
Well, another thing that kind of tickles me throughout is his kind of reviews of the service he gets, the people he meets. You know, Italians dancing, but the kind of service he gets at hotels, even reviewing how different people in different countries worship.
Right. Yes, and I think all of that becomes more amazing when you consider the humbleness of his background. I mean, working from working class Irish in the South Side of Chicago. Now he had not been, somebody that was able to enjoy lavish dinners or great service. He'd obviously read about those things, and so when it occurred, it impressed him perhaps even more, and especially more than if he had had some of that experience. But throughout too, he also had views that I thought reflected well on his consideration of things, where he said that so much of life has to do with status and so much of status has to do with birth, and we're all born equal, but the equality ends shortly thereafter.
If I understand correctly, despite the trip of a lifetime and the incredible things that he saw and wrote about, aside from one trip to Ireland, he never returned to Europe.
That's correct. I mean, part of it may be because of the burden of having a son who had to be educated, and the salary of a public school teacher in Chicago was not of great stature. But I think so much of what he absorbed in Europe was something that he carried with him then the rest of his life. And he thought about it often. He would see examples of it in architecture in Chicago or elsewhere. And it was indeed the trip of a lifetime, and turned out to be something that sustained him intellectually as well as emotionally for the rest of his life.
looking back at it, I mean, you said you'd always heard about this trip. Mm-hmm. Having read these journals now, do you think you know or understand anything differently about your father for having spent so much time reading these words?
I think I know him a little bit better. I mean, he was, for example, he shows a side of social skills that I think it certainly exceeded my anticipation. He was a fairly strict disciplinarian. So to see him cavorting about the dance floor with Italian women who he said whose dancing was more biological than physical, this is something that I could not imagine my father actually doing or saying. And coming in and out of these despicable places in Paris with naked women and the like and simply pointing out what they were like and otherwise enjoying a beer at the end of a day and watching the Glockenspiel in Munich from a beer garden and sipping wine and enjoying all of these kind of continental pleasures were all things that I would not have imagined for my father. And it makes me feel much better about him.
We should note, though, at one point he does write, at a certain point, one becomes satiated and ceases to record impressions. A traveler needs lots of rest because rapidity and number of impressions is a tax on the nervous system.
Indeed it is. And having my travel myself, when I read that, I was relieved because I thought it might be just me in terms of endurance. But and one of those times was when he was in Berlin and he was absolutely overwhelmed by everything is sheer volume of all the things going on. You know, you're at the Reichstag and you've got this. And the Olympics are coming there. So he's at the Olympic Stadium and they're having rehearsals and doing it. And the Nazis, soldiers marched in uniform and he would not stand up. And they came over to him and told him, you must stand up and say, Heil Hitler. And he refused to do that and said, I will only stand up and salute the flag of America. That's a story he told many times that has always resonated with me. And I always thought if he'd done that 3 years later, I would never be here because he would have been immediately executed, I think. But that thing, the thing in Berlin with all of this going on and the overwhelming presence of the Nazis and the swastikas and the parades and the fireworks and all of it was so emotionally and physically taxing that he didn't record those regularly in his diary.
Well, Frank Daly and Kurt Chandler, we are very grateful that you've shared it with us. Thank you both so much.
Mitch, our pleasure. Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be here.
Frank Daly's late father, Frank J. Daly, was the author and Kurt Chandler, the modern-day editor of My Trip Abroad, Europe in 1936. You can see photographs of Daly's 1936 travel journal at WUWM.com.